From the Sky News Centre at 6, the Prime Minister's hit back at comments by a former Chief of Defence Staff over his strategy in Afghanistan. Lord Guthrie has accused Gordon Brown's government of dithering over whether to deploy more troops. The PM says he's taking advice from military commanders on the ground and that when soldiers are sent, three conditions must be met.
Every one of them has got to be fully equipped for the task ahead. Secondly, the Afghan government has got to be in a position to send forces that we can train so that we can gradually pass over responsibility from the British forces to the Afghan forces. And thirdly, of course, we've got to have the coalition working together to achieve that.
Investigators are searching for a motive behind the mass shooting at a US Army base in Texas in which 13 people were killed. The man suspected of carrying out the attack, Army psychiatrist Nidal Malik Hassan, is in hospital after being shot four times by security police. President Obama says flags at the White House are flying half-mast. A former Army sergeant who made guns for gangs operating in Liverpool, Manchester and Birmingham has been jailed indefinitely. Detectives say Paul Alexander was a significant supplier of arms. The Chancellor says he's confident RBS will turn round its fortunes. The bank, which is part-owned by the taxpayer, has reported losses of £1.53 billion for the last 3 months and warned of further job cuts. The FA has honoured England's World Cup-winning manager Sir Alf Ramsey with a sculpture at Wembley. The bust is being installed in the players' tunnel area. It's been unveiled by the current England manager Fabio Capello with a host of Ramsey's world-beating players in the audience.
My life, when I meet someone that won World Cups, it's a big respect for these people because it's really important to life to win something, but I know to arrive to win, you have to sacrifice a lot of things.
And in boxing, the weigh-in has taken place in Germany ahead of David Haye's world heavyweight title fight with Nikolai Valuev. The giant Russian will have close to a 7-stone advantage in tomorrow night's fight. That's the latest.
This is the Stock Community, 93.2 FM.
Me merece. There you go. Start as you mean to continue, folks. That is the unmistakable sound of Los Desterrados. And if you like the sound of that, I suggest you get yourselves along to St. George's on Sunday, the 15th of November at 6 p.m. for a little bit more of that. It's an interesting sort of a fusion because they're Spanish Jews, if such a thing exists, since 1492. It's Sephardic music with a little bit of Balkan thrown in for good measure, Latin influences. And as I said, there is a little bit of klezmer too. So here we go, folks. This is the What? On for free in the next few days in the city. I'm going to do this in two stages. First of all, I'm going to do the free stuff, and then I'm going to move into the not so free stuff. But the not so free stuff is still very, very equitable. There we go. Now, tonight, this is quite important, Friday the 6th at 7:30. This is in St. Stephen's Church, which is just off the centre. It is the UK premiere of Victoria Terminus. It's a movie in response to Slumdog Millionaire, because actually Hollywood and Danny Boyle, while they may have done a nice job on creating a spectacular piece of cinema, they did sort of overlook some of the issues which Gerhard Vandervecht, I beg your pardon, addresses in this documentary. It's at 7:30 p.m. and there is a talk by the director, Gerhard Vandervecht, and I'm going to give you a little bit of the bump about the movie, just in case it's your thing. It is the opening movie of the unchosen Bristol film season. Free admission to all of these films. It's every Friday, 6th, 13th, 20th and 27th, all of this month, and it is facilitated by Nick Broomfield, whom some of you may be familiar with his work. It's usually fairly probing and unpleasant documentary making, which he's an important voice, actually, because he needs to be heard. It's not terribly commercial stuff, but it is nonetheless socially conscientious. So, the bump about Victoria Terminus, through tragedy, violence and abuse, Mumbai street kids survive and keep on rising like a phoenix from the ashes. After Slumdog Millionaire shun the global spotlight on their plight, here is a story from their own mouths. This is your stop. Welcome to India's Terminus Station, Victoria Terminus. There we go. I'm going along to speak to the curators of that this evening after I'm finished here, and I'm hoping I will have something to play out for you tomorrow on my own show, which goes between 10 and midday, specialising in arts and culture in the city of Bristol and all things world musically therein. Now then, the lecture series is continuing this week at the City Museum and Art Gallery. This is on Wednesday the 11th of November at 7:30 till 9. It's free. Professor Jeremy Black examines the grand tour of the 18th century to shed light on tourism and travel at the time and the cultural impact that it had on Britain. Now, I'm not sure if any of you saw Kevin MacLeod's grand tour of Europe recently and how it's affected the architecture of Britain, but literally every single bank on the high street, the Victoria Rooms, for instance, at the top of Queen's Road is a spectacular example of just how the grand tourists were influenced by the architecture of Italy and Greece and onward from there through France and back through the Alps, even as it progressed. Anyway, that's at the City Museum on Wednesday the 11th of November. Please go along to that. Now, I will play you a little bit of Bach on my way out. I went along to the Victoria Rooms at lunchtime today to listen to Sarah Shepherd playing Bach's solo cello suites numbers 1 and 4. It was mesmerically good. I can't recommend strongly enough that you do get along to the Victoria Rooms for the free concerts. Next Wednesday at 1:15 p.m. this is a free event. It's a concert of sound art curated by Neil Farwell. Bristol University Loudspeaker Orchestra present a concert celebrating diffusion, the performing art of electroacoustic music. Our program features music created in stereo, the familiar world of headphones or hi-fi, but conceived to be shared live in the concert hall over many loudspeakers. This is an interesting sounding experiment, folks. We're delighted to welcome the leading British composer Adrian Moore, who will perform his new work with the BULO, the Bristol University Loudspeaker Orchestra. The concert will be followed by a presentation and discussion with the composer. Now, that's a good one to go along to, actually. It sounds fascinating. And similarly, at the Victoria Rooms on Friday the 13th of November at 1:15, I say 1:15, I would suggest you get along there a little earlier than that because it's, well, it gets busy, frankly, because it's in the recital room and seating is limited. And it's a concert being given by the Bristol Opera Society in the recital room. Then, on the following Wednesday, I'm giving you good advance warning on this, the Brodsky String Quartet are there, doing two pieces by Simon Holt, Jeff Poole, and a piece by Peter Maxwell Davies, who I heard on Radio 3 this week is celebrating his 75th birthday, I beg your pardon. Right, there we go. Now, I'm going to stay up at the university for the time being because they do a lot of very interesting, fascinating, in fact, free lectures. On Monday, all of the details, I'm going to warn you at the top of this, all of the details of these free events at the university, please write down this website because then I won't have to repeat anything and Tony won't be confused by it. It is www.bristol.ac.uk/events, and that will put you onto the events page and all of the free stuff that Bristol University puts on for the public because they are in their centenary year this year. Now, as we're all aware, China is a growing power in the world economically and in many other ways. So on Monday the 9th at 6:30 p.m. there is Sino-American relations, indispensable partners or inevitable rivals. It's organised by the Centre for East Asian Studies and the presentation is being given by Professor Rosemary Foote from Oxford University. It's in the drawing room of Royal Fort Lodge on Tyndall Avenue. I beg your pardon, it's at 4, from 4 o'clock till 5:30. As I said, if you would like further information on any of these events, go on to bristol.ac.uk/events. On Tuesday the 10th, this is a fascinating series they're doing about feasts and festivities. It's at the Kings of Spain, 17th century court ballet and absolutist politics in 17th century France. It's organised by Peter Hardy and the Arts Lectures Committee, Dr. Marie-Claude Canova-Green, and that is also at the reception room in the Wills Memorial Building at 6 p.m. That sounds fabulous. There is also, in the Victoria Rooms on Tuesday, a musical instruments research seminar organised by the Department of Music, hosted by John Irving of the Institute of Musical Research at the University of London and Jonathan Scott of University of Bristol. This is at 4:30 in the afternoon until 5:30 and it's titled Performing and Recording Sonatas from 1750s Salzburg on a Contemporary Harpsichord, Some Pros and Cons. Now on Thursday, Vicious into Virtuous Circles. This is a very, very interesting, Tony was talking before the news about the new Bristol City Stadium down on the Greenbelt between Long Ashton and Dundry, or Ashton Vale as it's called by every other name. This is going to be a very interesting needle to that because it is Vicious into Virtuous Circles, Social Engineering for a Sustainable City. This is organised by the Bristol University Sustainability Team. Roger Levitt, co-founder of the Levitt Threvel Sustainability Consultants, and it's at the Pugsley Lecture Theatre in the Queen's Building at 6 p.m. on Thursday. Cities like Bristol could dramatically reduce their carbon footprint and improve the quality of life if we intervene systematically to turn behavioural vicious circles into virtuous ones. This talk will explain how and why. I cannot recommend strongly enough that you go along to this. And that is, contact for that is Paul Harper at bristol.ac.uk, or alternatively, as I said, you can go along and click on bristol.ac.uk/events. Now, there is lashings and lashings of stuff going on down at the Arnold Feeney at the moment, which ties in rather nicely again with the sustainability and the whole green issues. There is Ursula Biermann is doing Black Sea Files tomorrow from 10 a.m. till 6 p.m. and it's free. It's a video and research project about Caspian oil geography, which sheds light on a multitude of secondary scenes: oil workers, farmers, refugees, and prostitutes. That is just one of the many, many, many events going on there. I would recommend if you are, or if you do have access to the internet, to log on to www.arnoldfeeney.org.uk/100days. Right, that's all the free stuff taken care of because there is a lot of that. Very quickly, tomorrow night there's an Island Records night at the the Folk House. Next week, in fact tonight, Jules Holland and his Rhythm and Blues Orchestra are at the Colston Hall. Next week, Status Quo, David Essex, Motorhead. That's well worth going along to see. Also, I have been in touch with the Encounters Film Festival, which starts on Friday week, and they have suggested that Sophie Mayer come and join me on my show next Saturday, the 14th, which I'm very much looking forward to. Between now and then, they are doing, there's a season at the Watershed. It's Activists and Revolutionaries, a Sunday brunch season of environmental films. It started last week with An Inconvenient Truth, which won Al Gore much notoriety, an Oscar, and possibly a nomination for a Nobel Peace Prize. I cannot remember. This week's is A Crude Awakening, The Oil Crash. And this is directed by Basil Gelpe and Ray McCormick. It's a Swiss movie of 2006, which lasts for 123 minutes. I'm going to give you a little bit of the bump about it, balancing superb archival footage with the dire warnings of contemporary scientists and political experts. This is a compelling, intelligent and highly entertaining look at what will happen when our cheap supply of cheap oil runs out. The film hints at a humbler way of life built around sustainability, alternative energy, providing a visually stunning, boldly prophetic testament to which provokes us not just thought but action. Right, Brewery Theatre, go along and see Full Twist. It's fabulous. Bad Manners opens next Tuesday at the Alma up in Alma Vale Road. This Saturday, 8th of November, go along to the Watershed for a very, very rare viewing of Abel Gance's 1919 classic Jacuzze. It's 2 hours, 46 minutes long, but it's got an interval. That is one definitely for the movie buffs. Staying with cinema, double bill this week down at the Arnold Fini is The Eel and Vengeance is Mine by Shoei Inamura. Both plotting the beginning and the end of his career, I suppose you could say. Tomorrow, St. Mary Redcliffe in Bristol, the Bristol Bach Singers are doing a recital of works including Barber, Copeland, Whiteacre, Lauriston and Janet Ager. Go along and see that if that's your bag. Tomorrow night at St. George's, Handel's Messiah, which we all know and love. I've played it once myself. It's massive. Be prepared for a long evening. It's 3 hours long. And then more of same next week. If you would like a slightly more detailed catch-up of what's on, what's good, what's in, what's out and what's not, then please tune into my show tomorrow between 10 and midday. I'm sorry I've been so succinct with you this evening, but the traffic is torturous. Stay off the M32 inbound if at all possible. It's been a great pleasure. This is Pablo Casals playing Bach's Cello Suite Number 1, The Prelude.
We'll be looking again in a minute, thanks to Billy. Now, Billy, you're still with us in the studio here. Thanks for staying here, because we were chatting just briefly there about the Bristol City Football Club, the stadium move. What are your thoughts about some of the motives behind it? Because, I mean, they've already got a stadium.
They have a perfectly workable stadium that's actually very well used, I have to say. It is in the heart of the community down at Ashtongate. It's walkable a lot of the time. I know that the council have started recently adopting a fairly hard line regarding the double parking, the double yellow parking down around the ring road on match days. And it can be fairly treacherous. I mean, I used to live on Coronation Road not that long ago, and you always knew when it was match day. However, they've cut a deal with Sainsbury's, and Sainsbury's have a massive store no more than 400 yards away on the opposite side of Winterstoke Road. And I think it's absolutely scandalous, because that Sainsbury's store has only been thrown up maybe 15 years ago, if memory serves me. Obviously Ashtongate could do with modernisation. It's a bit of a relic, but it's still a perfectly workable stadium. And also, they use it. It's a multi-purpose stadium. Bristol and Bath played their rugby derbies there last year. There has been a number of rock concerts down there, and all of this stuff must have generated quite a lot of capital for the club. And also, we always prattle on about Bristol being at the cycling capital of the, and we're a very environmentally aware city and all that sort of stuff. So why on earth are they choosing to move the stadium where 30,000 people will, with anticipation, go once or twice a week? Making it necessary for them to get in their cars to make that journey. Whereas now, it's actually a well-trodden walk for an awful lot of people to run down one or other side of the New Cut or to come across Ashton Vale to get to the match on foot or on bicycle. I really don't see the logic of it. Also, there's a slightly more sinister side to this, which I have been thinking about, because I'm not sure how many of your listeners will be aware, but Stephen Lansdowne owns Bristol City. He certainly owns a controlling stake in it. Now, Stephen Lansdowne is also a vastly successful stockbroker, basically. He's one half of Hargreaves Lansdowne stockbrokering firm, which exists up in Clifton. And they were one of the very first companies, because after the whole shenanigans of the implosion of the economy occurred, I started tuning in and paying a little bit of attention to what was going on. Hargreaves Lansdowne, one of the shrewdest operators in this whole kit and caboodle, because they were actively recruiting while everybody else was laying people off, because they jettisoned all of their junk debt before anybody realised it was going to become junk. He's a very, very clever man. And there has almost certainly been some puppeteering going on behind the scenes that nobody is ever going to admit to, when a very wealthy man just acquired an awful lot of stuff for very little money.
But the fact is, of course, that the planning system works, where the way it works is that the developers have the initiative. As a developer comes along and puts in a planning application, it's really up to the community and the council to respond to it. But they have the whip hand in a lot of these decisions.
Well, they do. But if you use that same example with the developer having the whip hand and look at what's happened recently in Long Ashton, which is also going to be affected by this. They slapped up an enormous number of Legoland houses in Long Ashton because it's on the commuter belt, and they built a school with capacity for 100 children or something absolutely scandalous like that. And the council, I know it's North Somerset Council down there, it's still the same. I know personally some friends of mine, more than one family, who have moved to Long Ashton because it's a nice place to bring kids up. You've got countryside on your doorstep, and they still have to send their kids to schools on the other side of the bridge because of the oversubscription problems in Long Ashton. And you could say, well, they could go to Nailsea, or they could go to Backwell, or they could go to wherever else. But actually, if you're living and working, if you're working in the city, I beg your pardon, and you have to go, first of all, from your house in Long Ashton down to Backwell, Nailsea, or wherever else to get your child to school, and then get yourself to work for 8:30 in the morning, not only does it make it a very long day for you as the breadwinner of the household, but also your children are absolutely exhausted, and you're having an awful lot of your life and their life with you as a parent sucked out of it.
Sounds to me like there's not a lot of real planning going on in the planning system.
Well, it's quite buckaroo, quite frankly. And if we use a look at what's happened in Ireland, when the whip hand really was being held by the vested interests, the estate agents, the banks, the politicians, and the developers, that has now so imploded to the point that 84%, there has been an 84% increase in unemployment in men between 22 and 40 in the last year alone, because everybody, estate agents, bankers, developers, anybody who had any kind of an interest whatsoever in throwing stuff up and selling them to each other, or selling them to foreign workers who were coming in to do the menial jobs that the Irish no longer wanted to do. And you find it's a ghost town in many respects. There's no facilities, there's no resources, and there's no infrastructure has been put in for all of these toy townhouses. And also, there's nobody to buy them.
But
anymore.
Thankfully, the stadium will create jobs, won't it?
That's an interesting point, actually, because I was up on Bath Racecourse yesterday, and You say it creates jobs, which it might do for 6 hours a week for an awful lot of people. For the rest of the time, it's a pretty substantial white elephant. I mean, there are only so many conference facilities a city the size of Bristol might need. And one piece of grass is as much the same as any other piece of grass. What I would say in the defence of Ashton Gate, it's got history on its side. It's accessible, and actually, there has been a whole infrastructure has grown up around it. Instead of building some kind of half-witted infrastructure to try and get people in and out quickly, effectively and efficiently, that won't ever happen. And also, they're saying, let's get it together for 2018 for the World Cup. First of all, I can't really see World Cup football coming to Bristol because we don't have a Premiership football team in the city. And Bristol has no history of reputation for footballing excellence, unlike many of the other cities around the country. And also, we're maybe a little bit too close to London and to Cardiff for it to work effectively, because you've got the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff. You have a number of stadiums in London that will work perfectly well. Birmingham is very well resourced, as is Southampton. So I don't think it's absolutely necessary for Bristol to build a stadium at all. I think it will be underused and a huge white elephant and a massive waste of money. However, that's only my 10 cents.
Fantastic. Very interesting. Thanks very much for that, Billy.
Thank you for allowing me to rant.
That's what we do on here. Anyway, who is really controlling terror groups and why? We'll be exploring the BBC Time Watch documentary maker Alan Frankovich's work in a minute. But first, and somewhat appropriately, Marina Morris has been looking at happiness.
How happy are they? This recession is not easy time. Do the people of Bristol at least feel happy? We recently did a survey about how happy Bristol people are during recession. Before this, I would like to tell you of an old legend about happiness. Life is a mix of the quantity of years and quality, and life without quality of life has a little meaning. There is a legend of a cemetery of an Asian village where the years inscribed on a tombstone date from a person's birth, a date which adds to the year of birth the number of years living in happiness. The life which is celebrated is the years of happiness, the rest is discounted. This was an old Asian legend. Now we are in Europe. How happy are the people of Bristol? Here is our survey.
Happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. To me, this world is a wonderful place. I'm the luckiest human in the human race. I've got no silver and I've got no gold, but I've got happiness in my soul. Happiness to me is an ocean tide, a sunset fading on a mountainside, a big old heaven full of stars above, when I'm in the arms of the one I love. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Happiness is a field of grain, turning its face to the falling rain. I see it in the sunshine, breathe it in the air. Happiness, happiness everywhere. A wise old man told me one time, happiness is a frame of mind. When you go to measuring a man's success, don't count money, count happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. I got more than my share of happiness.
Last week, I did interview on the Bristol streets, and I would like to say it, Bristol people is very, very happy.
Maybe you could just tell us what it was that made you decide that you wanted to go and have a look at happiness.
I ask many people, now it's not easy time, it's recession time, and how they feel themselves. And it was very surprising for me, because there are many people said, we are quite okay. And when I ask them how you beat your depression when it sometimes can be, they say, no problem, we go for a walk very soon, Christmas time, and we stay happy.
If you had to score how happy you feel on a score from 1 to 10, how would you score yourself?
6. But because my job isn't too bad, but we're not having any pay rises because of the recession. So we have to do the same, if not more, amount of work because they've cut staff for the same amount of money.
I don't know, I'd go for an 8. But, you know, the problem is that if you're worrying about money all the time, you know, things are going to happen. If you're going to lose your job, you're going to lose your job. The worst thing is the not knowing rather than actually doing it. Because I've been made redundant before, and the worst thing was the not knowing. Once you know, you can then do something about it. You can go on and you get another job, everything else. And with money, you just live to your means. If you haven't got that much money, you just, you know, you curb your spending. Your lifestyle just fits around what you earn. So happiness-wise, I'm fine.
Still about 8. Yeah, great. But I don't live in Bristol. See, I live in Bath. but I work here, and it's a lovely city. Yeah.
Financially, you mean?
6.5, 7?
Actually, I'm an immigrant here, but for me, as a recession definitely affect my career, but I can say from 1 to 10 scale, I can give 6.
This really affect me, yeah. I'm alright.
You're okay. I'm the one. I've just come from university, so it's affecting me because I can't find a job at the moment. So, yeah.
How do you beat your blues? Do you have a recipe or any tips?
That would help probably as much. I read. That's it. Yes, read books. Chick flick. I don't know. I don't generally tend to feel sad, but I do like going out to the country. I like, you know, being outside in fresh air, walking, stuff like that. So that's important to me. Probably exercise, trying to see people you like. Yeah.
If something like motion things, definitely I watch movie or I listen music. That's a way I entertain myself.
Hobbies, maybe swimming.
Music.
Yeah, swimming for me, I think. Yeah.
How should the people of Bristol stay happy?
How to stay happy? That's a good one, isn't it? Try and find some spare time, and just do things you want to do.
I don't know. That's as much as I know, really.
Right. Okay. Just get out there, get out and about, do things as much as you can within your limits of your money, and try not to let it get you down. The recession. Well, just the kind of cliche of, you know, keep your friends and family around you, really, I suppose.
Having a planner.
Yeah, keep smiling. Yeah.
Stay warm.
Christmas soon, so.
Thanks very much, Marina, for those vox pops out and about. Now, Martin, I'm going to pop the question to you. You're a bit of an expert in economics, and you realised that we're going through. You recently lost your job yourself. How do you think it's possible to stay happy, even though you've got very little money or your income is going down and down?
Well, the way I stay happy is I realise that I'm time rich, even if I'm money poor. And there's lots of things you can do that don't cost a lot of money. I go for a lot of nice walks in the country because I've still got a car and I'm able to get out to the country. But, of course, you could go on public transport if you really had to. And the other thing I do is I read library books. I quite happily sit at home when the weather's like this and read a big fat history book.
Do you find that sort of being unemployed and applying for jobs each week gets you down after a while?
Well, it can do. Certainly it has done in the past for me. But we're all going to have to adapt, to, you know, just if people are worried about how their financial situation, they should ask themselves, how would you feel if you went to the doctor and you were told you've got cancer? Then you'd realise that your financial situation wasn't the main thing in your life, and it wasn't the thing that really made you happy or unhappy. Your health is your wealth, and people should remember that.
Right. Thanks very much, Martin, for that, and Marina for her report on happiness. During the last years of the 1970s, American filmmaker Alan Frankovich spent his time interviewing CIA whistleblowers, that's people from the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States. And this research culminated in a three-hour documentary called Inside the CIA, on company business, amongst scores of eye-popping revelations, mostly about US political warfare in Latin America. Frankovich revealed that both Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and President Nixon were both responsible for ordering Chile's 1973 coup. They famously installed the fascist General Pinochet into power, and over the next 20 years, tens of thousands of Chileans were disappeared. So we're going to hear now from an interview with Alan Frankovich, recorded in 1982, about what he says is a secret U.S. foreign policy.
The CIA, they have a kind of false openness. You see, a lot of what they do, for instance, in overseas posts, is they talk to the press, they manipulate the press. I would say that if you took a percentage of their operations, you would find that a great percentage-wise really have to deal with getting out their line through the media. Because if they accomplish that, in a sense, they control the way you see a situation. They control the way you think about a situation. So they have an ability, really, and they feel very much at ease with press and media. And they have, God knows, the number of books which have been written by former CIA people to take a pro-CIA position. And it's only recently that there are some people like John Stockwell, Philip Agee, and a couple of other people who have really decided, well, if the pro-CIA people are writing books, why don't we write books? But we'll really go into the nature of some of these operations.
So a lot of these people who are CIA operatives that you interviewed thought they were using you and manipulating you to get their point of view across. Wasn't there a point that they found out that this guy Frankovich may be doing a hatchet job on us? And at that time, did you get any less cooperation from the CIA or worse?
I don't think they really paid much attention to what I was doing. Because it was, I think at the moment when they realized that this film was on a scale that they had not even imagined, because you see, you're dealing with 5 years of your life. You're dealing with a research effort where I researched for film, background film, in just about every film library in the world. I did a range of interviews of 50 to 60 to 80 people. Now, on the other hand, you have to realize that, for instance, one of the persons interviewed in the film is a former president of CBS News, the founding president of CBS News and Public Affairs, and he says that when he became president of CBS News, they had a relationship with the CIA. He had inherited this relationship, and it involved providing cover to CIA representatives, but it also involved, and this is incredible, providing any material they had in their news library to the CIA. For instance, the CIA wanted to identify somebody in a country who was leading a demonstration. So you're dealing with a level of collusion, and you're dealing with the fact that there's a level of contact at the top level of the networks, and they're reaching 50 million people a night. So what the CIA is concerned about, they're not concerned about a little book or a little newspaper article in The Nation. They're concerned about things which really tell you the truth about what they're doing. And in this case, in CIA on company business, it's entirely told you by people in the agency. And then reaching a large number of people. Because the very reason they keep their operations secret is because if they try to explain them to us, they would find very little to justify them. And since this country is still a democracy, we're still allowed to vote, and God knows how long that's going to continue, they have to do this thing in secret. In other words, they're keeping them not so much from the other countries, because I'm sure, for instance, in the case of Chile, that the government of Chile knew the CIA was trying to destroy their government. They're trying to keep them from us.
So, Martin, do you think that that's possibly still true today, that some of the work that the intelligence agencies do is actually trying to conceal the correct facts and manipulate the media and actually conceal those facts from the domestic population? Because that's what he's saying there, essentially.
Yes, I can't imagine why anybody would imagine that it's not the case. I mean, that's what intelligence agencies are for, is to deceive. I mean, that's their raison d'être.
But this, I mean, isn't that surely the idea of an intelligence agency is simply to gather information to equip the armed forces to do their job properly?
Well, actually, you might say that, but of course, that's not actually what happens. That's the textbook, not reality. I mean, there's an investigation going on in the US at the moment about millions of dollars being spent by the Pentagon to persuade the public to support the war in Iraq. So the public's taxes are being used by the state to persuade them into certain lines of action and not other lines of action. There's some question mark over what's going to happen about that, but am I surprised? No, not in the slightest.
Okay, and we've also heard this week about a trial in Italy. I don't know if you've been following that.
Yeah.
Where I think it's something like 20, between 20 and 30 Central Intelligence Agency,
23
CIA officers and agency staff or whatever, have actually been convicted for quite long prison terms in their absence of kidnapping a Muslim cleric and taking him over to Egypt to be tortured. So with that, they have basically just gone round the official, if they want to extradite somebody, they have to go through the legal process, but they didn't in this case. They just kidnapped the guy and took him to Egypt.
Well, yes, I mean, what can one say? I mean, the CIA routinely works outside the law, as do most intelligence services. And of course, if we want to get back on top of this, we've got to put the law back at the heart of what we're trying to do. All of this stuff, the laws for children, you know, in the actual fact, you know, the intelligence services, we take no notice of the law, etc., etc. Well, that can't be the way. And the Italian magistrates have done a good job there of saying you can't just come into Italy, take people away and torture them without some comeback. And what people may not be aware of is that the Italian judiciary have wanted George Bush Sr. for many years to question him in relation to the Piazza Fontana bombing in Milan of 1969. Now, there is an Italian warrant out for the arrest of George Bush Sr. in relation to that bombing. But, of course, we don't hear this on News at 10, do we? Or on the front page of The Sun.
No, another thing Alan was talking about just there was the very close relationship between the intelligence services and, in this case, CBS News, and the head of CBS News actually being prepared to, first of all, hand footage over so that the CIA could identify specific individuals in a demonstration. And I think that there are all sorts of ethical issues involved there. But maybe more importantly, actually providing cover for agents. So that is, you know, having quite a cozy relationship whereby the intelligence service comes to the news organisation. And the intelligence service wants maybe a press pass or a CBS accreditation for one of their agents. And of course, this discredits, you know, journalists as a whole if it's felt that when someone arrives at your doorstep as a journalist, that they may be simply have been provided cover by whichever, maybe the Times or whoever it may be that they're working for.
Well, yes, and that's pernicious, and it means that it puts the lives of journalists at risk, because if people think that journalists are working for things like the CIA, the enemies of the CIA may decide to take it out on journalists as a whole. And the other thing, of course, is that the public is being systematically deceived, neither of which is ultimately acceptable in a democracy, in my view.
Okay, so let's have another listen to a short extract from that same interview back in 1982 with filmmaker Alan Frankovich.
A lot of people were starting to talk for the first time about things which had been done in secret over long periods of time. And I was able, therefore, to interview a whole series of people at every level of the CIA, from directors down to secretaries and accountants, and then spend a great deal of time actually researching coverage of events. Sometimes this involves CIA-created propaganda, which they inserted into the world media, and other times it involved contrasting what we were being told was happening in some country, and then contrasting that with the CIA operatives telling you what they were really doing, and that this was official United States policy, except it was conducted secretly so that we, the citizens of this country, would never know about it. The main point, really, is that this country has had a secret foreign policy ever since the end of the Second World War. And one of the essential instruments has been the Central Intelligence Agency. In other words, we've had presidents, every president since Truman has made great moral pronouncements. But the CIA has been the instrument they have used, actually, to consistently, and in every part of the world, this is interesting, it's not only in third world countries. The first CIA operations were in Europe. You have the United States government making great moral pronouncements and statements while it's using this instrument to penetrate, infiltrate, and destroy anything which gets in the way of what they define as the interest of the United States. And if you look at the historical record and you look at the countries the film goes into, you find that, for instance, the operations they conduct they haven't bothered asking us if we felt threatened by this, that, or the other thing. And often their economic interests that they're defending, as a matter of fact, I would say almost always. The thing was really to get people in the CIA who were talking for the first time to sit them down, have them tell the audience what they did, and to show consistently over a 30-year period of time that there were certain methods that were used, and they had nothing to do with national security, essentially. They had a lot to do with justifying these operations, whether they're against Chile or Guatemala or Angola or in European context. They had a lot to do with intervening in the internal affairs of a whole series of countries to force them to comply with what the President of the United States wanted these countries to do. And these kinds of activities are not something which just happened in moments of crisis. They go on every day in every country of the world. And they're the official but secret foreign policy of this country. And they're done specifically on presidential orders. And what will happen in 1974 and 1975, and I believe it happened primarily because one of the political parties, in the form of Richard Nixon, started using the same agency inside this country, not against dissidents, mind you, against a major political party. And therefore, when that starts happening, you have to tell your guys, look, this far, no further. And you start investigating them, you have to make a real investigation, because they know all kinds of secrets, they know where all the bodies are buried, and therefore, to rein them in, you have to investigate them. But the conclusions, I knew in 1974 or 75, they would never conclude that these were official government operations, that American presidents had ordered them, because the very nature of the CIA is to conduct these operations in secret, in such a way that if the CIA is caught, they take the responsibility themselves, and the President of the United States is protected. If you look at the assassinations of the CIA, claims they planned but never executed, you will find in the several cases the Church Committee went into, the Lumumba assassination, the assassination of the Commander-in-Chief of the Chilean Army, that a few days before these people are bumped off, a cable will go out saying, don't do it, guys. And nevertheless, it goes ahead. And this is, again, standard CIA operating procedure. These operations are done to preserve the cover, and so that the United States then can take a moral position while eliminating someone that they consider to be an obstacle to what they want to accomplish.
Okay, that's the second part of that interview from 1982. Martin, he was talking there a lot about the Watergate scandal, and saying that really that what was actually being used as a tool of foreign policy, a kind of clandestine warfare, was actually turned internally against Nixon's opponents. I mean, do you think that there's any possibility that kind of thing still goes on today?
I think almost certainly. If you think President Nixon was a bit of a rogue, just think of who's been running the United States in the last 8 years before Obama was elected. Even bigger rogues who actually got even less scruple than Nixon, which is incredible to say, is the situation.
And he's also talking about how that these kind of operations are taking place every day, not just in moments of crisis. So is there any kind of scrutiny or accountability of what these intelligence so-called services, the agencies, are up to?
In theory, there is supposed to be. In practice, there isn't very much. Senator Kerry investigated the Iran-Contra affair, and he had a senatorial investigation, and he uncovered the fact that Colonel Oliver North and his associates, many of whom later became Bush administration officials, were involved in the commission of terrorism, drug dealing, and murder, mass murder, and large amounts of drug dealing in order to finance their political allies in Latin America and in Afghanistan. We were talking about that earlier. But nothing was done. All of those people got presidential pardons. One of them was Robert Gates, who's the current U.S. Defense Secretary. It's not very well known, but when a president leaves office, he's allowed to pardon 200 people. And every president has had this power for generations. And, of course, the 200 people they pardon are the people that were doing nasty stuff on their behalf who got caught. And that's the way the American system works. But call me slow, but that doesn't strike me as terribly democratic at all.
So the idea is really, I think, what Alan's saying there is that you've got a secret foreign policy. I mean, what is the point of having a secret foreign policy? Why not just have a foreign policy?
Because you want to appear to be a good guy while you're actually doing nasty things. I mean, Hitler had a secret foreign policy. Britain has a secret foreign policy. Most countries do have secret foreign policies. It's part of the... But what they say in public and what they do in private are two separate things. And maybe we should be moving to a rules-based system, a rule-of-law system, where what you see is what you get. And it's the police in charge of investigating crimes, including crimes carried out by state officials.
OK, so we're going to move on now to have a little listen to an extract from a film that, it's quite a long 3 hours of, it was a Time Watch film shown on the BBC in 1992 that was one of the last films that Alan Frankovich made, and it's about something called Gladio. Now, can you just give us a bit of an introduction to Operation Gladio?
Me? Yeah, Gladio was originally set up by NATO intelligence agencies, particularly the US and British, to create a stay-behind force so that if the Soviet Union invaded Western Europe, there would have to be some resistance. These people were going to be the core of that resistance. And, of course, the Soviet Union never did invade Western Europe, as it transpired, but these core groups of intelligence-led terrorists, if you like, then started to do things inside Western European countries, which were nothing to do with stopping the Soviets, but everything to do with manipulating the politics, particularly of Italy and Belgium.
And he starts off at the beginning, because it's a three-part film, it was shown over 3 weeks back in 1992, and the series really starts off by looking at the end of the Second World War, and he talks about a figure called James Jesus Angleton. Now, do you know much about him?
He was head of CIA counterintelligence, and he was also one of the founders of the CIA before the OSS, before it became the CIA.
Now, so counterintelligence—that's a little bit like our MI5, is it?
The idea, effectively, yes, it's making sure that your own people are all reliable.
Let's get this clear, because I mean, a lot of people are unclear about the distinction between counterintelligence and intelligence operations.
Angleton,
so, what's the difference?
Angleton, when he was originally helping to set up the CIA or the OSS, as it then was in the 40s and the 50s, was not a counterintelligence officer. He subsequently became counterintelligence chief at the CIA, and eventually he was toppled in the 70s when he became so powerful that he was basically bending the intelligence to his own personal predilections, and became a completely megalomaniac figure, and had to be taken out, as they say.
Okay, so let's have a listen to an extract from the 1992 BBC Time Watch film about the OSS, the CIA, and James Jesus Angleton.
Alla mattina, appena alzata, oh bella ciao.
As the Allied armies advanced on the capitals of Axis-occupied Europe, the other war, the secret war of agents and partisan groups that had always been part of the bigger war, was to reach its own climax. As the Germans withdrew, they left secret agents in the countries they had occupied. The secret services call such groups stay-behinds. For the retreating Germans, they were the staunchest believers. They were selected from the SS and the fascist Black Legions. They were to become the foot soldiers of the next war about to begin, the Cold War. Ahead of the advancing Allies, always with the first troops, was the OSS, Office of Strategic Services. And that part of the OSS charged with locating enemy stay-behinds had been given the designation X2.
I came in and sent by General Donovan and got in touch with the heads of the military junta of the Committee of National Rule, which is the joint partisan groups. Then Jim Angleton appeared in August. He began recruiting fascists because he figured that the best way to control the communists was to hire fascists. One of the most tough ones was Prince Valerio Borghese, who ran what was known as the 10th Flotilla. These are the guys that would execute partisans and hang them from lampposts all over Italy. Angleton made a deal with Borghese and then rushed up to save this commander from the partisans who would have lynched him any time, because he had lynched thousands of partisans.
For 40 years, secret terrorist organizations, many trained by Western intelligence agencies, have manipulated the political control of European sovereign states by a campaign of terror and murder. Originally part of a secret network, these groups changed from being defenders of state security into attackers of the established political order. Until 2 years ago, that secret network was generally known by the single word, Gladio. On November the 9th, 1990, the Prime Minister of Italy, Giulio Andreotti, revealed to his own parliament and the world the existence of a top-secret European-wide network of secret agents. It was called Gladio. This network of stay-behind groups was intended to fight a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. Andreotti's announcement led to an immediate reaction in the capitals of Europe. The suspicion was that some parts of the Gladio structures were involved in internal subversion.
And what does that actually mean, Martin, when he's talking about internal subversion there?
Well, what it actually boiled down to was the encouragement of terrorist attacks both by the left and the right. So one of the worst such attacks was the attack on Bologna railway station in 1980 that killed 83 people. And what the Italian parliamentary inquiry uncovered, we don't hear this on the news at 10 or on the front page of the Sun, was that it was in fact NATO, a NATO operation that killed those people.
There's been parliamentary inquiries in Belgium and in Switzerland and in Italy into this. So, yep. I mean, this isn't conspiracy theory, is it?
No, I mean, Frankovic's film was shown on the BBC2 in the Time Watch strand. That is to say, it's historical documentary. This isn't like Panorama uncovering malfeasance or whatever. It's historical documentary. And it was shown once. And I remember watching it in 1992 and thinking, thank goodness this stuff is actually finally coming out and being shown on mainstream British television.
Well, the other
but
thing
it's never been repeated, of course.
Well, some people would say they shouldn't. They have too many repeats on the television, but not this one.
Not this
anyway,
one.
There's also a book out, isn't there? Daniel Ganser, who's a Swiss academic,
NATO's Secret Armies.
So that's also available. Anyway, our final extract is about the 1982 Belgian supermarket bombings. Which
they weren't bombings, shootings.
Sorry, the shootings, which came out, appeared to come out of nowhere.
30 years of innocence and peace in Belgium were shattered in the early 1980s. Citizens with no expectations of violence were murdered while shopping. No one knew who, no one knew why. Some suspected that right-wing elements in the secret services had penetrated left-wing groups and had even killed their own police to deflect attention from themselves. The suspicion was never proven, but nor did it ever go away.
Top secret. There may be times when host country governments show passivity or indecision in the face of communist subversion. U.S. Army intelligence must have the means of launching special operations which will convince host country governments and public opinion of the reality of the insurgent danger. U.S. Army intelligence should seek to penetrate the insurgency by means of agents on special assignment with the task of forming special action groups among the most radical elements of the insurgency.
The Defense Department and the President initiate any of those orders until there is an appropriate occasion.
In cases where the infiltration of agents into the insurgent leadership has not been effectively implemented, it may help to utilize ultra-leftist organizations.
So, Martin, do you think that there's really any relevance of this today, given that this is quite a long time ago that this
We're talking about 1982, 83. People perhaps listening to this don't remember this, but the Belgian supermarket massacres were where people with kind of Halloween masks and also just like looked like robbers, people with balaclavas, just walked into supermarkets and killed people at random with guns. They didn't even steal anything, so it wasn't like a robbery. And of course at the time people were, what's the motivation for this? Why are these people going around shooting people? But of course you heard the second bit there about the US secret warfare manual. What the Belgian parliamentary inquiry uncovered was that in actual fact these massacres, which is what they were, 18 or 20 people were killed in a couple of incidents, were carried out by these special agents in order to prevent the Belgian socialist government from refusing to site cruise missiles. The Belgian socialist government was looking set fair to say we're not going to sight cruise missiles in Belgium. And of course, Belgium is also the headquarters of NATO. This wasn't acceptable to the Americans, it wasn't acceptable to the British either. So they made sure some nasty stuff happened to remind the political class in Belgium who ruled the roost and who the daddy was.
Well, thanks, Marty, for helping with the analysis of that. Coming up next, it's Nemo and Somali Youth.
Greasy FM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.